General Duncan, Reel 11. Concentrating still on the training program of the Light Battalion, you've explained to me that its pattern, its routine, was much the same as applied in a medium tank battalion. Were there, however, any differences in principle or in detail in a training program for a light battalion?
No. No, there were no differences in principle, because after all, the result of you're in each case you're after exactly the same thing, which is the rapid application of armoured firepower.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically speaking, that's what the whole of tank training is about. In detail, yes, of course, there were, because you in the light battalion you had a much greater range of movement. You could spread your tentacles, your wings would carry you a bit further than they would. It seemed that track mileage and petrol were a little lighter. We were always being badgered about the amount of petrol that we used. And therefore it was important to get every blooming inch you could out of your mileage. Kept on saying, well, if we can't, why the hell can't you cut the hay of the horses a bit down below and give us a bit more petrol? That never got us anywhere.
Was there ever any form of rationing imposed on petrol supply?
Oh yes, you were given from time to time thundering edicts used to come out that you were only allowed so much track mileage a month or so much petrol a month. Petrol had to be cut down and economised, and you use one lorry instead of making two journeys. That sort of thing. As far as I remember, I was never handicapped by petrol shortage, by the fact I couldn't get enough petrol. I used to get rockets exceeding my petrol allowance. There was another hell or there.
I'd like to ask you a few questions about one of your non-company responsibilities. You told me you became president of the battalion mess during this period. How did you come to get stuck with that job?
That was my own choice.
Why did you make it?
I was living there as a battery officer. My wife was living in my home. And I was extremely uncomfortable in mess.
In what ways?
Well, I didn't think the food was particularly well cooked. I didn't think the waiters were particularly good over there waiting. I didn't like the way the place was cleaned. I didn't like the kitchens very much. I thought the cooks looked slightly dirty. In fact, I thought it was slightly scruffy. And so it was the next mess committee meeting. I volunteered. It was very unusual, a very stupid thing to do. But saying that I was the only senior officer living in mess at the time, that I would take on the job of PMC. And so I did, and we got on to it.
What did you do? What changes did you bring in?
Oh, just smartened the thing up and demanded a higher standard of cooking. This again is to be you can't particularize anything. The moment you demand a higher standard, the chap will give it to you if you can lead him to it. And there was a good mess sergeant who really wanted a bit of encouragement. And we laid in a bit of a cellar. It was very bare, you see. The Light Battalion had restarted itself much later than anybody else. And so things like lampshades and pictures and so on were lamentably short. Well, the only thing to do was to go out and get them. You got them by scrounging off your friends or getting them to get things for you from your home, making chaps give you a certain amount of money, reorganising the funds to provide the silver fund. That's all. It was all perfectly straightforward, normal routine, just merely putting something which was running all right into something which was running very well.
Had Tank Corps officers' messes their own particular style or any particular traditions?
No, we were engaged in the business of making our tradition. That's been the fun of the whole thing. Normally speaking, there were in every regiment there was somebody who liked his creature comforts and was determined to have them. And he was the chap really who was the power behind either the PMC or the power behind the mess committee and driving them to it. The commanding officer's point of view, you see, a very good appointed, well-run officer's mess and sergeant's mess and corporal's mess is almost essential. Again, if the place isn't clean and isn't comfortable and isn't tidy, you can't expect a man to be clean, tidy, accurate in his behaviour.
You said you were engaged in making your traditions. What ones did you see evolve during this period between the wars?
This is the evolution over long years from 1916 to 1976.
Mm-hmm.
What has evolved over that period? Is professional competence to a very high degree, immense self-reliance.
Okay, so no particular RTC mess styles or traditions.
No.
1937 exercises, you've mentioned a number of things which interested me. This involved the Light Battalion in some schemes and exercises with the Heavy Brigade. Describe those scenes for me and tell me about the exercises of those years, what came out of them.
The short really, you see, of going back to the actual exercises and going through them in detail. This is a frightfully difficult thing to evaluate. The Light Battalion's job was reconnaissance for the Heavy Brigade, and that involved movement on a wide front and over considerable distances, so that your exercises, you were changing formation continually. You were keeping in touch by wireless, which was not very easy because you were on long, very, very wide fronts, very great distances, and still working on the one battalion frequency. So the need for extreme condensation in words was more than ever evident. We did what really sticks in my mind much more are the exercises that we did as a battalion, which were varied in extent, usually with the independent role in view, with the operations on one flank or the other, or well in front. I can remember going down to, we did one going down to Lulworth on the training, all the bridges on the Froome were presumed held, and if you came down them, you were put out of action. And the intelligence officer found a ford and went straight through, delighted with himself. He caught a trout on the way, too, came in over the driver's hatch. The rest of the battalion came over. But that is just merely the sort of ordinary probing functions of a reconnaissance unit.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other ridiculous exercise. Well, the commanding officer had set two squadrons, two companies, to fight one another, and announced that there were no holds barred, that this was total war. So they started out in the middle of the night in a fog. I was the third company. I was going to put in on whichever side was losing in order to counterbalance the story. In the middle of the night, in the hell of a fog, I lost my way. And then they ran my commanding officer down, who said, "Well, so and so." And I said, "I don't know. I haven't seen anybody. And there was a frightful scene. He got across to me. I think because the scheme was failing, yes, it was ready. I happened to be handy to vintage Rawthorn. Anyhow, after waiting for somewhere around about an hour and a half, I and the other squadron which was about was sent home, company, we were sent home. And when we got home, we said to the third chap, what the hell happened to you? And he said, well, I got a letter telling me the exercise was off. And this was a bit of paper which said, exercise cancelled, return to barracks immediately. The signature of the commanding officer's signature had been forged by the other company command. Oh, blandly said, well, you said total war and nothing barred. My God, there was a scene.
That's a lovely
put
story.
In Coventry about a week after that, not spoken to. We thought it was rather good, a rather good jest.
Great initiative.
This continual insistence on the dispersion in space and concentration in time really made up the tally of the exercise. It didn't vary to any great extent from any other one.
I mentioned the schemes with the heavy brigade during 37 because you suggested earlier that as a result of those there was demonstrated some of the sources of conflict which you had with the cavalry.
Yes, they were.
What did you mean by that?
Well, the cavalry, our resources, the cavalry were given a pretty scratch collection of tanks, old Mark IIs and Mark IIIs and Mark IVs. And they made continual, ever-increasing demands on us, on our very meager resources, in order to keep them on the road. When we complained, we were told to shut up, that they had to be mechanized forthwith. It wasn't, it sounds absolutely ridiculous, but it was damned annoying when something had gone wrong with one of your own tanks and you wanted the machine repaired in your own unit workshops to find that they'd been diverted off to look after some cavalry regiment over something which they could have done perfectly well had they had the knowledge. That was the rub. And of course he was completely intolerant of us. We were the professionals, and we ought to have known. We ought to have borne this perfectly happily. The difficulty, you see, was that the cavalry caught the general eye down on. They lived down in Tidworth, in a big garrison. They played polo, they hunted, they were in the public eye the whole time, and they got a great deal of attention, which we thought ought to come to us. After all, we were people who knew about tanks. And they were newcomers and slightly upstartish and bloody condescending about it, and they really didn't care two pins. We got to where we were by sheer ruddy hard work and nothing else. As far as we were concerned, our very existence depended on the tank doing exactly what it was told to do at the time as quickly and efficiently as possible. A professional attitude. Mm. They didn't mind any more than they minded when they were horse soldiers.
In the development of your professional techniques, I think one of the interesting features of this period with the Light Battalion was your first experiments with night firing.
Yes.
Well, what was the setting for that, and how did it work out?
Well, to tell you, this was speculation. This all blew up one night, one day in the mess. We were talking about the possibility of night fighting. Somebody said, I don't believe it's possible to fight at all by night. I think it's absolute nonsense. And I remember I said, I don't give you, I think the searchlight's got a hell of a part to play. And the commanding officer said, well, we better well go and try. And to me, go and find a place where we can fire the guns. So I went and found a place which looked as though it might be reasonably safe. We took out two companies, mine being one of them. And we then lined them up, purely formal test with two objects in view. One was to see how accurate the fire could be under searchlight illumination, and the second one was to evolve some means by which the searchlights wouldn't be shot out of existence the moment they started. It involved putting our troops in line, assigning the targets, doing it in a slow time. We switched on all the lights so that the targets were illuminated, and then switched them off. And then we started playing various combinations of lights. We fired a feu de joie lights, with starting off with a single light on, single light off, next one on, and so on. And you've got a ripple of light running the whole way down. They then tried it in twos and tried it in threes, and then we went to the stage of trying it by a section of lights on there and a section of lights on there, and then two sections in the middle and so on. Various combinations like that, and spent a couple of happy nights playing about, and came to certain quite different conclusions, which were aware that you could shoot quite comfortably by night, that your period of safety with the light on was about 10 seconds, which is what it would take a chap to get a weapon unpacked or get himself behind a weapon when confronted with the light suddenly. And that the control of the lights, you wouldn't want to use the wireless, but it had mucked the thing up. We tried a series of light signals and hadn't really come to any final conclusion, but got enough to say, well, it was a perfectly practical operation. They were ordinary spotlights. They weren't searchlights in any way. They were ordinary spotlights, about 10 inches in diameter, sort of thing they used to fit on the old big lorry.
Did your innovations have any repercussions in the other battalions of the tank corps?
No, because they hadn't got searchlights.
I see. Mm-hmm. What about that problem you mentioned of some means of protecting your lights? Did you come up with any ideas about that at that time?
No, but in actual fact, we came to exactly the same result as the CDL light by turning a light on the extreme flanks, and then in the middle, and then on the flanks, and then in the middle. The CDL chaps hoped that they would achieve total blindness because of the night adaptation. All we were concerned about was protecting our own lights, and we did that by short exposure.
I see. Mm-hmm. Apart from improving your nighttime efficiency, were there any steps taken or any experiments tried out or any developments at all in the field of communications within tanks during this period?
Communications within tanks were non-existent, of course. And what is much more, they were non-existent within the company too. We always wanted a short-range wireless set in addition to the long-range one. We never got it until the war. You control the driver was controlled at the whim of the tank commander. Some people used to use a pair of reins tied onto a ribbon or string tied onto his elbow with a pre-arranged cone and jerks and pulls and tugs and so on. Others were much more elaborate and fixed up various flashing devices, bulbs which went on and off. Others still adapted the old-fashioned principle of holding onto the tank, launching forward and kicking our driver sharply in the ribs, right or left. That's probably the most effective of the whole lot, but you had to be fairly long to do it. But the solution of that, of course, had to wait until the war.
Yes.
Matilda came out with an intercommunication system, which was so bad that it had to be scrapped completely. And we got that's a later story.
Right. We're jumping this short period that you spent with the 44th Infantry Division. In November 1938, you were posted to the 1st Tank Brigade, again at Perham Down, as Brigade Major. What was the scope of your duties as Brigade Major?
All embracing, that's rather the answer. As a brigade major, you stand in the same relation to your brigadier as an adjutant does to his commanding officer. You are his mouthpiece, if he likes to use it that way. You're responsible for the correspondence, for the running of brigade headquarters, and for the general supervision of the actions of the brigade on the operational side. You have to draft all the operational orders. You're responsible for the operational, the standing orders for the brigade. You're the senior staff officer at brigade headquarters, and therefore everything connected with the brigade, the staff captains working in provisions, logistics, the modern phrase, the training of the protection troops, the training of the signals, and all that sort of thing, the actual running of brigade headquarters, its organization in war and peace, preparation of the charts and documents and so on, which concern you again on the operational side.
Mm. You describe that function as being different from battalion activities, in that instead of running one house, you had to run three. Could you develop that analogy a bit?
And what's more, not only have you got to run three, but none of those houses belong to you. And therefore, your personality alone carries you through. You've got none of the battalion machine is there. You have no regimental sergeant major immediately at hand to see the thing works. If your orders go out to the brigade, you and you alone are responsible for seeing those orders are carried out.
Did your personality see you through?
I think so. Yes, I enjoyed it. Yes. I enjoyed it a great deal.
With any difficulties?
Any difficulties?
Mm-hmm.
We had difficulties because I used to recall our disposition of the brigade, the two battalions over at Warminster and two battalions over at Pelham Down. The Warminster battalions intended to become a slight splinter group of their own under two extremely forceful commanding officers who really almost got to say at times and saying, well, Warminster doesn't think this.
Who were they?
Well, one was a man called Gross and the other was a man called Rimmington. They were both... of course, the thing was quite different, you see. It's quite different from an ordinary brigade job. After all the people over at Warminster were my brother officers in my own regiment. They were all personal friends of mine. As were the people over at Pelham, as was the whole of the tank brigade. This was the nearest approach to Nelson's band of brothers that you almost ever see.
But you're suggesting also that the strength of character of some of the battalion commanders perhaps created a sort of state within a state a bit.
Oh, yes, indeed. But I mean, on the stage that... Where you call for some brigade return or things like that, and the people over at Warminster think that this is war, they're prepared to say so to you when you go to see them with no uncertain terms. That point of view, it's quite different to having your three battalions disposed in a 5-mile ring, 20 miles separating the two of us. Although I used to go, I was over there at least twice a week regularly. They could get up to all sorts of games on their own, and did.
Mm.
As I say, the whole thing was entirely within the family, and except for the fact that you had to learn, you couldn't take liberties with battalions. You can't, of course. After all, it's an organisation of its own under its own commanding officer. You can't go and give him orders to do something which is directly contrary to his policy. If you do, of course, you're very fooled. There are occasions when you misunderstand your brigadier's intentions or circumstances at one end are quite different to those attending at the other. And that has to be adjusted, that's all.
Mm.
It would be perfectly easy to do.
Yes. You've put this all in very general and slightly theoretical terms so far. Could you give me any examples of working relationships, specific working relationships, which illustrate some of these points you're making?
I don't think I can.
Okay.
I do so gladly. The point which cropped up most often were the detailing of battalion instructors for a tour of duty at the schools, or at the depot, or a posting abroad, or the in-posting of some chap who battalion commander didn't want, or two battalion commanders. And when you would go, you would then go over, or be asked to go over, to be attacked by two commanding officers who would say, look, here are two instructors who've just qualified. Schools say they must have them back. One man is a first-class key man in the battalion football team, and the other's got a wife and family, and they're just here, and they can't let over without either of them to make that quite clear. I cannot let them go. Well, the school's policy in those days, or at least the regimental policy in those days, was that the best wasn't really quite good enough for the gunnery school, and they had to go. Therefore, you had to sit down and argue the case out with the commanding officer. And if you were unable to convince them, then you had to go back to the brigadier, and he had to give a ruling. But in actual fact, I was fortunate. I never had to, come back on my brigadier for a ruling.
Who was your brigadier at this time?
Justice Tilley.
What was he like to work for?
Oh, he was a wonderful man. Wonderful man. Wonderful. He'd been everything. He'd come into the tank corps during the war. An extraordinary wide range. He'd been out of America. He'd been a cow puncher. He'd been a professional pugilist. He'd been almost everything. And he was a very sound tactical soldier as well. And
were there any areas in which he made a special contribution?
His most potent contribution was in the line, I think, of tactics. We'd always... we would spend hours and hours and hours trying to concentrate fire on enemy columns. crossing the T, the naval crossing the T, so that all your guns bore while only two or three of the enemy guns bore. And we used to try this on, to do this on the move, which was clearly impractical in actual fact because the gun wasn't stabilized and the quality of shooting was extremely erratic. Justice, I think, was the first man who said, well, it isn't good enough to just hit the tank anyhow. What you've got to do is hit the particular bit of the tank, either the driver, the commander, or the gun. And you can only do that from the halter. And therefore, what you've got to do is you've got to maneuver in such a way that you take up position protected by ground where you can effectively dominate the enemy by gunfire. That was one, and there were all sorts of other questions. The mine in those days was the thing which was concerning us a very great deal. I remember all sorts of experiments. We got to try an agricultural tractor. I borrowed an agricultural tractor and tied some reins on the steering wheel, see whether you would steer it from a vehicle behind, which you couldn't in actual fact. Although I think that sort of vehicle is probably the answer for the future. We developed smoke. That was another quite interesting one. Quite apart from the long-range smoke, which are close-support mortars fired. We had two tanks with 3-inch mortars in each company. They were supposed to put down a distant curtain of smoke, but what you wanted was a lifebuoy. Something which you put down absolutely plumb like a... We thought about... We wanted to project it in front, but we couldn't. We hadn't got the mechanism. But what he could do was we fixed up four smoke candles at the back of the tank and were in frames on either side above the track, wired them up electrically. Wires were run from these candles electrically into the... to the commander, who could ignite the candles, either singly or in mass, create a smoke candle, a smoke curtain, behind which, into which he could turn his tank and thereby escape the attention of the anti-tank gun. which was then becoming rather a factor. This rather followed examples of use of anti-tank, the guns in the anti-tank road in the Spanish Civil War.
Talking about these developments like smoke, for example, which reflected particular needs which you felt you had at any time, I was wondering to what extent, when you had minor needs, or even larger ones, you used your own resources in meeting those needs, as opposed to feeding them in terms of problems to the appropriate military research establishments or civilian manufacturing companies. How was home help balanced against...
As far as possible, we always did the thing on our own resources. Because it was quicker. And if we wanted oddments, we bought them out of our own pocket. And that was all. If it entirely depended how badly you wanted the thing completed. If you could get hold of any regimental or brigade fund which would pay for it, so much the better. If not, the only answer was to buy it yourself.